Welcome. I hope you're all having a great day of learning so far. I just want to name that it is nothing short of ridiculous to try to have a deep and meaningful conversation about the search for God in our lives with so many people in a room, but we're going to try anyway. And I'm going to start with a little bit of a ridiculous metaphor. I often think about what the search for God means when I open up the refrigerator. Multiple times a day, open up that refrigerator, looking for something, not quite sure what it is. There's lots of things in the fridge, thank God. Things don't seem exactly right. This thing might be a little too salty, that's a little too spicy, this might be a little too sweet. Some things, a little questionable. But in all seriousness, I think when we're opening that fridge and trying to figure out what are we doing as we're staring in that fridge, we're trying to fill some sort of craving. And it's a craving that we might all have multiple times a day. And even if we're not sure that the answer will be in that fridge, it's really that craving that I want to linger in. And here's how I've decided to pave a path for our learning all together as a group. There's two paths that we're not taking. We're not going to spend time on philosophical abstract texts about God. A lot of opportunities to do that, other times in the day, other times in our lives. It is very rich, but I think that isn't always the most inviting way for people to access language to delve into our own personal searches for God. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. And instead, we're going to focus on poetry and prayer. And we're going to step into the shoes of people who are wrestling with many of the texts and traditions that are part of Torah, where we're going to see it through their lens to try to actually engage with God. Their voices will primarily be directed to God, not speaking only about God. Number two, path not taken. We're not focusing on beautiful sunsets, though the cover of your Jungian booklet might have led you in that direction. We're not going to focus on the feeling that you might have in a beautiful Kabbalat Shabbat with lots of singing, though that might be critical in your search for God. We're not going to focus on seeing a baby's face and maybe accessing God in that moment. There are many places in which you might find God, but we're actually going to focus on things that are hard, that might feel like obstacles to use my metaphor of the refrigerator, even open that door to look for God. And the reason that we're doing that is because I think it's the only thing that's really worth our time all together as a group in a day that's about the search for God, to think through how do we deal with those questions, those doubts that might make it so hard to even want to search. And we want to run with those theological questions and struggles instead of running away from them. And really bring those questions into our direct address to God and direct engagement with God. Okay, how are we going to do this? We're going to follow a particular roller coaster of a trope that appears in Jewish liturgy. And this is the idea that in the face of God, we are dust. We are but dust. And we're going to start on some apparently kind of solid ground of traditional liturgy and follow it through, trace its swerves, both by going back to certain sources in the Bible and also primarily by going forward to look at three poems and prayers and that were written in more recent times. These poems and prayers, which all happen to be by women, represent a desire to be in relationship with God, even though it is easy to feel like one or like we are on the margins of that relationship the way it can be described in traditional texts and the Torah that we have inherited. And I say that regardless of our gender. It can be very easy to read something in the Torah about God and feel like, oh, but there's no way that could be talking to me. No way that could relate to my experience. So in other words, we're going to jump into these poems and prayers in order to dive head first, to the question of how do I search for God, even if at face value, the Torah does not seem like it helps me find God and might even sometimes make it harder to find God. We'll have a little bit of the Akedah. We'll have a little bit of Amalek. Obviously, there's tons and tons that have been written about these very good questions, but again, what's unique here is to see how particular individuals in their attempt to actually pray to God are invoking these texts and relating to these moments in our tradition. I hope that stepping outside of what we might think of as the usual yeshivish canon will be really an opportunity for us to put ourselves and see ourselves and our own questions through the lens of the composers of these poems and prayers, who are trying to do that work of relating directly to God, even though it can be so hard. Okay. Larger goal of our learning: try to forge a path in search for God that hinges on, rather than tolerates at best, our deepest doubts. A search that hinges on our deepest doubts. A path that can orient our experiences and responsibility in the world with constant reference to God, without reducing God to the limits of our own experience. That's what we'll try to do today by tracing this metaphor of dust. Okay, we're going to start with a very early poem from the Book of Psalms. We're in the charcoal dust-colored pages of your booklet. We're going to start by reading this psalm together. It's really just a couple of verses from the psalm. We could spend the whole day on the psalm. And then I will ask you to turn to a chavruta sitting next to you and reflect on it for a minute. But first, we're going to read it. Lo chachata'enu asan lanu v'lo chavonatenu gamal aleinu. Ki chigbo shamayim al ha'aretz gabar chasto al yireyav. Kirchok mizrach mima'arav hirchik mimenu et pisha'enu. Kirachem aval banim, richam anonai yireab. Kihu yada yitzreinu, zachor ki afar anachnu. Enosh kechatzir yamav, kitzitz hasadeh ken yatzitz. Ki ruach avra bo veinenu, velo yakirenu od mekomo. Bechesed adonai meolam vaad olam al yireab, bitzit kato livnei. Take a minute to turn to your chavruta, somebody sitting next to you. You can read through that psalm in English first, and then reflect particularly on line 14. Going to give you a question before you talk. And reflect on this image of dust in line 14. For God knows how we are formed. God is mindful that we are dust. What does this image of dust mean to you? How does it feel to walk around like dust? Is this something you connect to? Is it something that is repelling? Read in English and then reflect on those questions for a few minutes. Okay. Sort of like Coke and Pepsi game. Who's for the dust analogy? Raise your hand. Who finds this terribly repelling? Okay, Great, we're gonna hear from both sides. People who find the dust metaphor compelling or powerful, why? What does it do for you?
It's true.
It's true, we're all composed of carbon-based material primarily and water.
We all go to dust.
Okay, so certainly sort of the scene of we start from dust, we end in dust is just a fact of life. Yes?
It just works on so many levels. Like we discussed how we come, like the carbon thing is like important. We are the same material, but also that the size is alluded to, like how tiny we are and how we come and go and we have no control over the world around us. Like all of these things which are like so crucial, like the understanding of human struggle, like how we look at ourselves in the world when we really like think about the scale of the universe. Thinking of ourselves as dust makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and because it's that God knows we're dust, and we know we're dust, but God cares about us all the same.
Okay, God knows we're dust, we know we're dust, and yet God cares about us. That's part of the message here.
So I thought the dust analogy has a different side to it, which is God knows we're dust, we'll return to dust, but while we're us, we're this incredible combination of atoms and protons, electrons that form amino acids and form proteins and form our living, animated, moral choosing selves. And we're created in God's image. And so God stands back and says, these carbon-based dust molecules have formed into this extraordinary thing in which I have to have a relationship and care for. And when it disappears, as my Habruta partner pointed out, I actually will care for the children's children. My commitment to this extraordinary dust creature is in reverence and respect for what it is. Not that it's so small, but that it's extraordinary.
Okay, thank you.
Also, like the fact that this metaphor harkens back to the literal creation of humanity, that we can't remember the time that we were the dirt that hadn't been yet created into man. We didn't exist. Only God can remember that time, which has to do something maybe like our children's children, for example, won't know who we were. They'll only hear of who we were because they weren't here. That there's some continuity maybe offered by the idea that God, who knew us as a people before we had even been created, you know, will know us when our children are around. That there is a continuity, it's just outside of us.
Okay, we're going to take one more comment on the pro-dust camp. Sorry, just behind you.
When I think of dust as being super tiny, I think of this image of we're all these kind of specks on this like huge sphere that's like floating in this like random thing called outer space, and we're just like these little specks on this like suspended earth, and how like bizarre and random that feels. And that to me is what I feel most like dust. And also in those moments, everything can seem really arbitrary and constructed and like a game almost. And it can be like, yeah, God is aware of that feeling. And you can put more of that feeling and like is there with you in those moments where
Okay, so a God's eye perspective from sort of a universe perspective, we notice that we are dust in this vastness, and God sees that also, and God is sort of with us in that, so that there is possibility. Okay, let's hear from some people who hated this verse of Psalms.
We, I think, both of us, hated this verse. We felt like, you know, there's that saying, I am but dust and ashes, but the world was created for me, like having both in your pockets at the same time, but in this psalm, there isn't that balance at all. So that's what really bothered us about this particular focus on us.
Okay, so the dust piece might actually be more powerful when it's counterbalanced with other horses. We're going to get there.
Okay.
Great.
The difficulty I had in reading this is I almost read it as saying that God is forgiving us because, you know, or has compassion for us because we're so low down, we don't even matter to him. And it's not like we're challenging God in some way or we're above, you know, we're high enough up so that we're actually worth paying some attention to. It's just that, you know, it's easy to forgive things when they have no consequence to you.
Okay, so it sounds like some of the tension in our readings here is the message of this psalm and the dust and forgiveness and kindness a sign of God's care or a sign that, well, we don't really matter anyway. What we do doesn't really matter anyway. And so God can just sort of wipe it clean. Yeah, one more comment on the anti-dust.
I think one of the issues that I had with this idea of dust is that on a very fundamental level, it kind of conflicts with how all of us, I believe, see ourselves in that just on a day-to-day level, we wouldn't be able to do things that we all do, you know, get out of bed, take care of the people close to us or other responsibilities if we truly thought that we were nothing and that we just were specks or however you interpreted that. And so while there is a lot we can read into it and it's nice to have perspective, I think that on a fundamental level, it's hard to actually truly internalize because we all do get out of bed and we all do take care of the people close to us.
Okay, thank you. So this image of humility and awe vis-a-vis this vast, eternal God also seems to totally obscure our sense of agency and responsibility. Okay. What's in the Tanakh, what's in the Bible, is important. But what is sometimes more important as somebody who is a Jewish person and inheritor of the rabbi's reading of the Tanakh, is how pieces of the Tanakh, like how passages in the Bible, make their way into prayer, and especially daily prayer. I think about this a lot. If you think about where the passage of the Song of the Sea is ends in the daily prayer book generally. It's right before the little part about Miriam taking her timbrel. Many people actually include that as well. But what's in some ways more important than what's in the Bible is how that becomes part of our lives, and in one way that is through prayer. So I want to turn to page 2 for a second and say that this theme of I am dust finds its way into the tradition of prayer. One of the earliest sources for that is in the Talmud, that's source number 2 on the top, in Tractate Brachot, where we see that Rava, who some of us learned about a few minutes ago, had a tradition of saying after his silent Amida, a prayer that is really a meditation on this theme of dust. My God, before I was created, I was worthless. And now that I have been created, it is as if I had not been created. I am dust in life, all the more so in my death. I am before you as a vessel filled with shame and humiliation. May it be your will, Lord my God, that I will sin no more, and that those transgressions that I have committed cleanse in your abundant mercy, but not by means of suffering and serious illness. He would say this, it seems, every day after he prayed. It might look more familiar to us from the Yom Kippur Vidui confessional service, and indeed, it makes its way into the prayer book. This is in the earliest prayer book, Seder of Amram Gaon, in both those places. Some people do say this as a daily confession. There are still some who do that today in certain parts of the Jewish world who have this confession as part of a daily practice before Tachanun. And it is also in the Yom Kippur Vidui liturgy. And I want to sort of think about, what does it mean to say a prayer like this every day, maybe even three times a day? It seems that Rabbi might have said it after every time he finished the Amidah. And what does it mean to say this once a year? Another place that this theme of dust is prominent is, in fact, in the weekday Tachanun. We cite the verse from Psalms at the end of Tachanun. Baroges rachem tizkor, ki hu yada yitzuner zachor, ki afar anachnu. In the bold, in wrath, God, remember mercy. God knows our nature. God remembers that we are dust. And I think in some ways the climax of this image, that we are dust, we sin, and yet we want to invoke God's mercy in the face of our sin, reaches ahead in the High Holidays. We have in the Avinu Malkeinu that we say on the High Holidays and at other times in the year, remember that we are but dust, so Chor Ki Afar Anachnu. And I think a place where this theme really reaches a climax is in the High Holiday prayers and the way that the Akedah is invoked. So I gave you a little excerpt from Musaf Rosh Hashanah. Don't worry, there's still a number of months before Rosh Hashanah comes. But I just want to read to you the way that the Binding of Isaac is invoked in the Rosh Hashanah Musaf prayer. We're on page 3, Roman numeral 2 here, source number 1. May the binding that Abraham bound Isaac, his son, on the altar, and subdued his mercy to do your will with a full heart, so may your mercy overcome your anger against us. And remember with mercy the binding of Isaac for his descendants. Today, blessed are you, God, who remembers the covenant. This is really the climax of the Zichrono part of the service of Rosh Hashanah. And I think, I don't know how much you've thought about this, but I think the image here is, it's a complicated image because there's both Abraham and Isaac in the image. But I think part of what's happening in this image is we, like Yitzchak, are standing here on Rosh Hashanah. We deserve to die. We're on the brink of death because we sin. We are human and we have our limits and we sin. But God, have mercy on us and save us, just like you saved Yitzchak. I think that it doesn't use the language of dust, but I think that is what it is meant to be invoked here. That we, like Yitzchak, basically deserve to die. And I think Abraham, who is a little bit more complicated in this story, is also being called upon here as someone who, in a way, relinquish any sense of agency. It was totally submissive in this moment of the Akedah, and we are glorifying that act. And you get to that weird imbalance. It's an uneven equation here. Just like Abraham overcame his mercy, so too God, you should not overcome your mercy, but actually have your mercy overcome your anger. It's a very strange kind of non-equation in the High Holiday liturgy. This theme also appears in Slichot. We invoke the passage of the Binding of Isaac. I gave you a little excerpt here, source number 2 here on page 3. May the one who answered Abraham at Mount Moriah answer us. May the one who answered Yitzchak when he was bound on the altar answer us. Right, so what I want to suggest here is that the Akedah is here in part, right, to really reach a climax on that theme of we are nothing before God, and yet, God, in all of your mercy, save us anyway. Now, what I think is strange about the way this motif appears here is that if you trace Abraham and the language of dust, you actually arrive at a source that is very different than how some of our anti-dust interpretations were reading the psalm that we started with. But if you look in in Bereshit, or in this, one of the stories of Genesis, where Abraham is turning to God to argue about the destruction of Sodom. Abraham says, but I have only, I'm sort of venturing to speak before God, Nina no Alti, Poati Vedeber El Adonai, Vanuchi Afar Vaeher. But I am dust and ashes. So Abraham's statement of being just dust and ashes in this passage is invoked in later readings, such as the Midrash that I gave you here, number 4 here, Bereshit Rabbah. It's elided, sort of conflated, with Yitzchak's ashes, where both of these are meant to be signs, I think, of patriarchs who saw themselves as dust, were totally submissive before God, and that their merit is invoked in times of crisis, such as in fasting. But if you actually pay a little bit more attention to what is happening in the context of Abraham making this statement, I am but dust and ashes, this is not about submission at all. This is the beginning of Abraham launching into what even Abraham thinks is a pretty undefensible request of God. If this is in the midst of his vayigash, he steps up to God when God says God is going to destroy Sodom. Abraham steps up, challenges God, are you actually going to destroy the righteous alongside the wicked? It makes an argument, maybe if there's 50 people you should save the city, and then it's when he's going to keep going, continue to challenge God in a way that even he thinks is like, maybe not so defensible. But that's where he says, I'm but dust and ashes, and even so, I'm going to continue challenging you, God. So that dust and ashes is actually a dust and ashes that is the launch pad for Abraham being an extremely strong and vocal agent vis-a-vis God, in a way that, as many commentators have talked about, we do not see Abraham acting after he gets the command of the Akedah to bind his son. Okay, so with that background, we're going to launch into the first text that I want to spend a little bit more time on. This is the first of the more recent poetry that's going to engage with this theme of being dust or being small. And then this is source number 5 on page 4. It is a trina. That is Yiddish for supplication. It is part of a genre of Yiddish prayers that appeared in early modern period. This happens to be an 18th century prayer. Some of these, not all of them, were written by women. This is by a woman named Sarah Bastoving. She authored quite a number of these prayers. If you want to learn more about that, you can read a book by Chava Weisler, Voices of the Matriarchs. And we will see here what she does with this theme of the Akedah, the way the binding of Isaac is invoked in prayer on the high holiday, in the high holiday season. But what I mean to do is to have a reading of this dust and ashes, total submission piece of theology. We're going to see what she does with that. For a little bit of background, she says, this trina should be said before making the candles on Erev Yom Kippur. What candles, you might ask? We might think of Yom Kippur, we might think of Yahrzeit candles. The tradition of burning Yahrzeit candles on Yom Kippur. This tradition didn't originate in the supermarket aisle with buying Yahrzeit candles. There was actually a folk ritual that is attested to in a lot of halachic sources and ethnographic sources of taking wick, really long strands that would turn into wick, measuring the circumference of cemeteries, and then bringing those wicks home, rubbing them with wax, invoking the names of ancestors. There are actually two candles made, one for the living, one for the dead, so invoking the names of ancestors who had passed away, and invoking the names of living relatives, sort of having everybody pray together for a prosperous new year, and those candles were then either burned at home or taken to the synagogue, where they needed light for the full 25 hours of prayers for Yom Kippur. Sort of a beautiful image then of all of those names of people in that flame of candle burning alongside the worshipers in prayer on Yom Kippur. Okay, so this is a piece of the prayer that she writes during that process of making the candles. And I brought it to you in English and not Yiddish, because I don't know Yiddish. Kind of ironic. This is written for a woman who didn't know Hebrew. I today can't understand the original because I don't know Yiddish. So we're going to read it in translation. Ribono Shel Olam, I beseech you, merciful God, to accept my mitzvah of making these candles for the sake of your holy name and for the sake of the holy souls. Yihi Ratzon, may it be your will, that we may, this Erev Yom Kippur, be remembered favorably by him, God, because of this mitzvah of making the candles in Shul. Now, listen closely. And as I prepare the third thread of the wicks for Avram Avinu, so we see here that the practice isn't only about invoking personal ancestors, but going all the way back to the matriarchs and patriarchs. As I prepare the third thread of the wicks for Avram Avinu, whom you rescued from the furnace, so may you purify our sins and misdeeds so that our souls may be pure when they come into the next world, just as they were when given to us, pure without fault, and entered into our bodies without fear or terror. And through the merit which I gained by preparing the wick for the sake of our mother, Sarah, may Hashem Yisbarach, God, praise be He, remember us for the merit of her pain when her beloved son, Yitzchak, was led to the binding. May she defend us before God, praise be He, that we should not, chas v'shalom, God forbid, be left widows this year, and that our children should not, chas v'shalom, be taken away from this world in our lifetime. Because of the merit of preparing the wick for the sake of our father Yitzchak, may you have mercy upon us, who have commanded us to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, using the horn of a ram, a reminder of the binding of Yitzchak. Remember this merit so that we may be able to provide for our children's needs, that we may be able to keep them under the guidance of a teacher, so that they may become accustomed to your service and respond. Amen, Yehi Shmei Rabba, may the merit of my mitzvah of candles be accepted as equivalent to the flame which the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, lit in the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, so that it may illuminate the eyes of our children in the study of the holy Torah. I tried. Okay. There are people who look at these prayers and say, great, woman's prayers, it's about being a mother, it's about children, sort of a beautiful, personal, kind of domestic view of Judaism and Jewish practice. But that is in part true. Though you should know that Sarah Bastoli, based on her introductions to others, to some of the other prayers she wrote, it doesn't seem that she had children personally. If anything, she relates to her written works as her children. So I think that there is something deeper happening in this prayer theologically. And I think you can get there by tracing how she invokes the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, in this high holiday season. Okay, so I want to hear a couple of comments from you now that we've read this together. How does she invoke the Akedah? How does she invoke the binding of Isaac? How does it compare to the way it is invoked in the Rosh Hashanah Musaf that we saw, right, that glorified Abraham for binding Isaac, his son, subduing his mercy, and God then having his mercy overcome his anger? How does she invoke the Akedah? How does it relate to that other image of the Akedah? Thoughts? Number one, who does she invoke the Akedah? Which of the ancestors does she invoke the Akedah with? Sarah and Isaac. Not Abraham. Not Abraham. Okay, so the first thing that is extremely interesting, and she's a pretty literate person, is that The way the Akedah is invoked in the holiday liturgy about glorifying Abraham's deed of bringing Isaac to the binding, and even what we saw in the Slichot, Misha'ana Abraham, may the one who answered Abraham respond to us also. She refuses to associate the Akedah with Abraham. There is no glorification of Abraham's deed of bringing Yitzchak to the binding and the slaughter. In fact, she reaches for a little bit more of a sort of second order tradition about Abraham that comes from the rabbis, from the Midrash, about Abraham being saved from the furnace when he's thrown in there after trying to smash, after smashing his father's idols. Okay, so that silence, I think, is critical. How does she interpret the Akedah? What seems to be the message of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, in this text?
Yeah. Well, she sees it from Sarah's point of view and her pain at Isaac being bound and almost sacrificed.
Okay, great. It's not Abraham's, sort of glorifying Abraham's willingness to lead Isaac to the slaughter. It's Sarah's pain at the possibility of losing her son. Okay, she's standing on very firm ground in here, and we know that there are midrashim that talk about Sarah's pain in relation to the Akedah. And I may have even given you some of them here. Yes, on page 6. Right, this tradition goes all the way back to Vayikra Rabbah, Leviticus Rabbah. This is an early 6th century-ish work coming from the land of Israel. People may know this very well from Rashi, who comments on the juxtaposition of Sarah's death after the binding of Isaac, that she died, right, just on hearing the fact that her son might have been about to die. And that here, I think very powerfully, the shofar, the blasts of the shofar, are correlated with her wailing and her screams. And it's a very powerful midrash. You know that Rabbi Shai Held has written about this midrash in the high holiday season. I think it's extremely powerful. What I think is, in some ways, even more powerful here is to not just read this midrash. Right? This is what I mean by bringing us to poetry and prayer. Not just read that midrash, right, which is a critique of the Akedah through Sarah's pain, but to actually invoke that in a prayer when turning to God. And I'd say the most strong way to say this is that Sarah Bas Tovin's prayer here is Sarah saying, God, save me. God, save us from Avram's search for God. And I think hearing that in the language of prayer, right, not just how could Abraham do this? How could God tell Abraham to do this? Which are very powerful questions, but to turn to God and say, I can't even mention that Abraham did this. God, please save us from this search or the consequences of this search is an extremely powerful voice. Yeah.
I think it's especially interesting that when she's describing.
Maybe stand up so we can hear better. Thank you.
Describing Sarah and asking for her defense, it says not just that our children shouldn't be taken from us, but that we shouldn't be left widows. That had Abraham completed what he set out and intended to do, he would have been as dead to her as the child. Like, she would have been a widow. Like, his search would have taken away her entire family. This is very
interesting. Yeah. Okay, very powerful. Thank you. One more comment on this for now.
I don't understand why she's not raging against God, because God's the one who started this whole thing. God's the one who's been going and all those things in, as far as her family goes and the son goes. There's a big disconnect to me.
Okay, thank you. Yes, what is maybe most kind of striking about this prayer is that this is a devotional text. It's an extremely devotional text. And she's turning to God to say, save us from this possibility of how the search for God can end up. Right? And right, her whole orientation here is about instilling Torah in her children, right? Instilling the power of prayer in her children. So she is not screaming at God and running away. She is bringing this in to how she understands God must be in the world. Right? I think, but in a way then, the constructive piece of what this is doing, not just the critique, but the constructive piece, is to kind of refashion the meaning of the sacrifice that a parent might perform in relation to their child through a model that is more about the ethics of care and the sacrifice of care. Right? It's like, as a mother, the sacrifice I want to perform for my child is to be able to provide for our children's needs, keep them under the guidance of a teacher so that they learn to pray, so that their eyes are illuminated with Torah. That takes a lot of sacrifice. And that's how she's invoking the sacrifice of Isaac here. Okay. We're going to move on. But hopefully you see here one example, and one relatively early example, of a critical stance around the possibility of what the search for God can become, and through a devotional framework, reframing what that search should be about. We're going to move now to a poem that is a little more harsh. And as we read it, I will say probably the first couple of words will make some people uncomfortable or want to dismiss this entirely as kind of an angry rant. And I hear that. But I think the reason I want to bring you this poem is as an example of one of the hardest obstacles or questions that can burn inside of us, that can prevent us from opening that door to try to search, right? And right, in some contexts, this came up downstairs an hour ago and sort of couldn't have not come up today, right? That might be the fact that the Holocaust happened. How can we even search for God in the wake of that? For some people, this might be dealing with ongoing illness that can be crippling. And here, we're going to look at a poem that deals with the fact that there is systemic acts of violence in the world, and in this case, particularly gender violence, and how we can possibly try to search for God and imagine that there is a God to be searching for if people are not held accountable for these deeds. Okay. Just as a, I know this is kind of an intense topic, so if people need to kind of check out for a minute at any point, if you review some of the sources you saw early in the morning, and that is also fine. Okay, we're going to read this poem. This is by Shulamit Halevi, contemporary. She's a scholar of medieval Jewish history. She actually focuses her work on the Moranos Conversos, or that whole piece of medieval Spanish Jewish history. And she's also a poet. She lives in Israel. And this is a poem that is the epilogue of a collection of poems called Ot Hevel, The Mark of Abel, which we'll talk about more. Okay, I'm going to read this poem. Reach Simon, oh sorry, title, Sha'asani Kirtzono. Reach Simon Territoria Zicharit Rovet Al Yad Keska, Zachor Ki Afar Anachnu, Karka Olam. Hezidonot Vashkagot Atamakir Haratzon. The scent marking male Torahtiri crouches next to the throne of God. He remembers that we are but dust, ground of the earth. Intentional versus unintentional sins, you discern. Will or desire versus coercion or grace. Powerful poem, pretty harsh. I'm not going to shy away from some of the uglier parts of reality here. I want to offer you two readings of this poem. I would say that the heart of the poem is the third to fourth line. Zachor ki afar anachnu, that's our verse from Psalms. God remembers that we are but dust. Which she pairs with the phrase karka olam, the ground of the earth. Karka olam you could read as a metaphor for afar, for dust. But she is drawing here on a rabbinic text in the Talmud that understands what Ahasuerus did to Esther as treating Esther like ground of the earth. And this is actually in a passage in the Talmud that is establishing Esther's passivity and innocence in the sex acts, or really, I think this one would say, rape that occurred for Esther in Ahasuerus's palace. But the language to describe that is ground of the earth. And that phrase carries on in terms of a longer history of Jewish texts to describe woman's passivity or submission or really being treated treated like dirt, I would say. And so I think what she's doing in this poem, in those lines, is turning the language of confession into accusation. Right? How do you say those lines? We are but dust. If one's experience of the world is actually being treated like dirt. And I think, right, she goes on then to continue to invoke words of confession. Hazidonot vashkagot atamakir, right, you know intentional versus unintentional sins. God, if you know the difference between an act that is done intentionally versus unintentionally, an act that is done when there is consent, versus an act done under coercion, then why is it that we live in a world where there is violence and people doing intentional acts that coerce others and they're not being held accountable for it? If God, you know. And God, you should be holding people accountable, right? So this is her, right, responding to the language of confession that might be in our prayer book. And I'd say this is some of the strongest, for those of you who are anti-dust, because it seems to take away any, you know, sense of agency that we have. This is her saying, how can I even say those words as confession when I can only hear them as accusation? And if you go back to the beginning of the poem, then her language, that sounds fairly harsh, in the beginning, invokes the story of Amalek. And I want to read this part in two ways. One, the words she is using, Aliyad Kes Ka, come from the description of the war with Amalek that is found in Shemot, in the book of Exodus. That is source number 2 here, on page 7. Ki yad al kes ya milchama la'ashem ba'amalek midor dor. Right? A sort of cryptic phrase, the hand upon the throne of God. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. I think she invokes that verse, one reading of this, is to see God in terms of being constantly at war, sort of God as a part of a story of male aggression and dominance, and that is the opening line of the poem. And I think you can read this then as a total rejection of God. How can I believe in a God whose desire, it seems to be, based on the facts of the world, is to allow for people, in this poem, woman, to be treated inferior and at times to be treated like dirt with no accountability? And I would say, like, at this point, that reading of the poem is total rejection, walking out of the possibility of being in relationship with that God in any way. But I think there's another layer here, which is the story of Amalek in Devarim, you have at the bottom of page 2, top of page, or bottom of page 7, top of page 8, source 3 here, is that God's war against Amalek isn't just to be at war. God's war against Amalek is God's promise to constantly hold accountable those who attack the vulnerable. Right, the opening of the story, the way Amalek is told here is Amalek, as he surprised you on the march when you were famished and weary and cut down all the stragglers in your rear. So God, who is constantly at war, what the story of Amalek is supposed to be about is that we have a God who is actually going to notice when there are people who attack those who are vulnerable and is going to hold them accountable. That's the God of Amalek, and she then is, I think, turning to that God and saying, where are you? Step up. And in that reading of the poem, then, those opening harsh lines about Reach Simun Territoria Hazcharit, right, marking the sort of male marking of territory that she sees as crouching near God's throne, Roveitz, that word Roveitz, brings us to the story of Cain and Abel, where God says to Cain, sin is crouching at the door. You could be gripped by it, but you could be strong and overcome. And so I think then she sees there's a possibility for God to be kind of hijacked by this sort of violence that could occur at the beginning of the poem, but God doesn't have to be. Right? That is sort of hovering near God's throne, but she is calling then, I think, on God and God's will to actually live up to that God that is fighting against Amalek and is going to hold accountable those who commit acts of violence against those who are vulnerable. And I think to tie this back to the fact that this is the epilogue in a book called Ot Hevel, The Mark of Abel, right? The story of Cain and Abel, there's no mark of Abel. There's a mark of Cain. What does that mark mean? It means Cain, who committed an act of murder against his brother Hevel, is actually never going to be put to death for that act of murder. And in fact, if you read the story in Genesis, it's quite troubling in a lot of ways. Right? He's told that he's going to be a wanderer, but he goes on to establish a city. He's the beginning of civilization, which does not seem like sort of wandering at all. So it seems that Cain is actually not really punished for his sin. Right? And I think she's reading this as, God, you made a mark on Cain, and we live in a world, in a way, depending on the genealogy that you sort of, how you interpret the genealogies of Rishi, we may all be descendants of Cain. And we live in a world where those who attack the vulnerable are not always held accountable. That is just the world we live in. And she is calling for a different reality where there is Ot Hevel. There is actually a mark of Abel. And you can read this, I think, also in two ways. Ot Hevel, you could read Hevel there as futile, right? That promise that God makes is sort of futile. It lets those who commit these acts of violence get away with murder, literally. Or, right, I think the constructive reading of this is asking for Ot Hevel, wanting to live in a world where God's assurance is that those who have, right, suffered, those who have been the victims of an act of violence actually have assurance that there will be accountability. Okay, I want to kind of close the discussion of this poem. I'll take a couple of comments in a minute, but I want to close the discussion of this poem with actually an excerpt of a piece by none other than Andrew Bellefonte, who besides running programs at Hadar also writes and wrote a piece in the Huffington Post in the wake of violence in Orlando just a year ago against queer people and the tragedy of that event. And I bring this to you to sort of sharpen what I mean here by the language of confession turned accusation. How do we inherit this language? We are but dust in a world where there are actually people who are treated like dirt, and there is not always accountability for that. Okay, I quote. The teaching of Rabbi Bunim of Pshiska says, everyone should carry two slips of paper, one in each of their pockets. One piece of paper should read, I am but dust and ashes, and the other should say, the world was created for me. It's important for us to hold these two truths close and to maintain a sense of balance in the world, to remain confident, to remain humble. Right now, all I feel, and I feel this in very deep ways, is that I am just dust and ashes. I feel completely burned, charred, incinerated, like my life has been destroyed, like I am something people step on, and perhaps, most significantly, like the world was not created for me. So that, I think, thank you for those words, that, I think, is one of our strongest articulations of this, right, confessional kind of we are nothing posture, which turns into, right, God, please forgive us of our sins, we are but dust, we don't have agency, can have a dark side, which is also losing responsibility and accountability in a world where people can actually be treated like dust. Okay, I want to take a couple of comments on this poem before we move on.
So, if this poem, the scent of male territory is the chatat, right? Is the sin that crouches at the foot of God's throne? Is she using the next line to suggest zachur? When you smell that scent, you should remember that we, the victims, are afar, because she's kind of translating afar as karka olam, right? That like zachur ki afar nachnu is not our deeds are insignificant, but we, the victims of that male aggression, are insignificant. So when you smell that scent, you should remember that to take the side of those who are the afar and not those who are
worse. Yeah, right. So I think you could read it as like, notice what you're trampling on, right? And I think if you also read in here, right, the in the wake of the murder of Hevel, right, his blood is in the ground. So I think it could be, right, notice the dust and dirt that's being trampled upon here. So at first, that message of acknowledgement. I think you could also read it as zachur, related to zachar, right, that is male, but in contrast, afar anachnu, we, the victims of this, are on the other side of this throne being trampled on.
It kind of leads to the end being, well, if you discern zdonot versus shkagot, and the willing versus that which is forced, it almost turns that into a call to be less forgiving with those acts that are zadon and those acts that are ones, because being forgiving of acts of ones is an act of dismissing or denigrating those who are the victims.
I think that's right. Right, that she's saying there's really a dark side to this message of we are but dust, please forgive us. Well, if God's going to step in there and forgive, where's the accountability for some of these real sins that have, right, need to be addressed? Right now, obviously, sort of rabbinically and halachically, you could go through, there's forgiveness with God, there's forgiveness with Bin Adam Chaveiro, peers, and it's not meant to all be, it's not like you just say this vidoy and everything's fine. But I think she's saying it's sort of hard to say those words of vidoy as a confession when there's a dark side there of where's the accountability. Okay, one more comment on this.
I think there should be accountability to those that turn their backs on the victim, because it's not only the oppressors that should be accountable, but it's those people that just wasn't doing that.
Yeah, I think that could be here too, right? Again, if this is sort of the dust speaks, I think that's why you might want to think about what's happening in this poem, right? That what could be sort of just trampled upon, ignored, right? There might be some who have committed particular acts of violence that need to be held accountable, but then there might also be those who aren't noticing the dust, whether they've trampled on it or not. So I think it's really just that moment of, right, the ground speaking. Okay, where are we now? This is pretty harsh, perhaps even depressing. But I hope is sort of a pretty sharp articulation of some of why it is hard to live in the world and search for God, right? And I would say, sort of to summarize in the most, I don't know, kind of crude way, it's like, you read this poem, I don't care how beautiful the davening was on Yom Kippur, so long as there are vulnerable people in the world being treated like dirt and nobody's being held accountable for that, our search for God is not really going very well.
Right, sort of a dead end. We don't know that.
So I think that she's partly, right, clearly we live in a world where there are attempts, right, through our justice system to hold people accountable, but there are often also cases where people are not held accountable.
Right, but in the picture of the world where there is God, there is afterlife, so we can't really say that, right?
Right, so I think, right, she's speaking about an experience of people in the world as well, where the afterlife might be one important piece of the picture, but it's hard to live with if that's the only piece of the picture. Okay, what I want to do in our last 10 minutes together is try to pave a way towards some kind of constructive rendering of what we can do with this tradition, we are but dust, and how we wrestle with that, and arrive at some more constructive way of balancing humility and responsibility, right, awe in the wake of God, and also agency. And that's where I'm going to do something that was even scarier than sharing with you that harsh poem. I'm going to share with you our third poetic prayer text, which I wrote, page 9. And I do this not because I believe that my poetry is particularly good, but because I think part of my message here in drawing us to these poetic and prayer-like texts is that it's not just about how we talk about God, it's how we bring that into a direct engagement with God. And so I would actually invite all of you, maybe you think of yourselves as writers, maybe you don't, but part of the search for God might not only be reading other people's books, and learning a lot of Torah, ideally in Chavruta, but also trying to write out some of your own thoughts or feelings in relating to God. Okay. As a preface to this poem, I just will say two words. When I was 25, I married an atheist. He identified as atheist at the time. Totally commonplace. There are 450 to 500 million people who identify as atheist or agnostic in our world today, according to one recent study by the Pew Center. And I share that with you because our relationship began as actually a sort of poetry chavruta, sharing different poetry that we had written. And what I found in his work was that all of his doubts and questions were not actually so different than my own and those of many other people who I knew, and that that for him wasn't a reason to kind of either become apathetic and walk away from Jewish tradition and Jewish practice, nor was it, okay, I'll just sort of sideline what I'm really thinking about and go ahead and do the actions. It was the source of a lot of creative poetry, drawing very richly and deeply on Torah, Tanakh, right, and the whole rabbinic canon that we've inherited. So I say that whatever you think about God, not God, you might not think you can write a poem about God, but who knows what will happen if actually you use that as a way in instead of a reason to close the door. Okay, this is entitled After Shacharit. It was written after Shacharit one day, 10 years ago. And the image here is seeing one's shadow after Shacharit. She is a shadow, this God of mine, stretching far, rooted at my heels. Tzila uveret, nimtach ad ein sof ne'echaz ba'afar akevai. So what I'd like you to do is spend 1 minute, kind of a 2 minute chavruta total, spend 1 minute reflecting with somebody sitting next to you on what you think this poem means. I'm going to read through it now with what I think this poem means. And I'd love to hear what everybody else thinks, but it might be that most of that is happening over lunch. Okay.
Did you ask the English or the Hebrew first?
I wrote the English first. Okay, but I think the Hebrew is actually much better. Okay, Tzila Overet. Besides some of the gender play that's happening there, the image here is that the shadow, right, the language Tzel Over is from Unatana Tokef, but also it goes back to the psalm that we started off with, that our shadow is us, but that actually we are also only who we are by virtue of the sort of fleeting ruach, right, our neshama, our soul of God that passes through us. But the other sort of piece of that shadow is that, right, what I think a lot of this session has been about is that God and the search for God can really have a dark side, especially if it's limited to just being a reflection of who we are. So if God is sort of, God can be caught in being limited and reduced to certain human experiences and the limits of humans' ability to search for God. I think that's part of what's happening in the feminist critique in the earlier poem, and that can have a dark side. Nimtach ad ein sof, stretching far, and the root matach can mean literally to stretch. I brought you a midrash you can check out on page 10 that uses that verb in talking about God's creation of the world. But also, right, this is meant to be the possibility of transcendence. Right, so that shadow could sort of end with our reflection, but imagining that the sort of God that is in that shadow and the God that that lives through us and animates all of us can also transcend the limits of our experience, the limits of what we think could be possible in the world as we know it. Ne'chaz, caught, a reference to the Akedah, where there is a ram that is caught in the bush and is a resolution for the tension of the Akedah and the sort of catch 22 of the Akedah. So Nimtach also has a valence that means to be in tension, not just physically a rope stretched in tension, but also, right, turmoil, tension. And using the word there, Ne'achaz, is meant to reach for the possibility of some kind of resolution. But also, right, caught in the dust of my heels or rooted at my heels, right, this is really the moment in this poem that is meant to be about that combination of humility, right, seeing myself as just dust, myself as just a passing shadow only animated to life because God decides that we get to live for some period of time. But at the same time is some level of taking responsibility, taking agency. So if we picture our shadow, starts at our heels, right, the point here is our search for God and what our search for God brings to the world basically depends on our own feet and what we decide to do in the world. And there's another intertext here, which is Heschel talking about praying with his feet. Right. And so I sort of feel like the reason this poem is here to close our session with our dust imagery to bring us back to that feeling of dust that some of us really felt attached to as an acknowledgement of our limitations, finiteness, and also a sense of awe for being a part of this larger world. Sort of critical piece here with the shadow that starts at our heels could maybe transcend way beyond us, is that we need to take responsibility for our search for God, even as we have awe for God, because the way God is known in the world is very much influenced by, if not totally limited to, the way that we search for God in the world. So that's the tension of this shadow, and that we need to take responsibility, realize that, right, it's sort of up to us to create that Ot Hevel and to live in a world where people can search for a God who holds us all accountable. And right, at the same time, to have a sense of humility and a sense of responsibility for making that search for God fruitful. Thank you for your time.